We are going to get started. We are in session number four. So we're already past the midpoint. So you're already, more than halfway to being A-deem Zomimim experts. To recap and catch us back up, we have been spending a lot of time in the Mishnah of A-deem Zomimim. The Mishnah themselves are very complicated, right? In part because this is such a bizarre way to talk about false testimony, and it has, these few very interesting rules. Just to recap, one of the rules that we learned was that you have to be testifying about the possibility of the testimony itself, right? As opposed to testifying about anything that is in the fact of the case. We talked about the irrelevance of having more witnesses on one side versus the other. Like you might have thought, oh, well, if there's 1,000 witnesses who say one thing and two witnesses who say something else, you might be inclined to listen to the 1,000 witnesses. We determined that that's not true. We always listen to what I call witnesses B, our good friends, witnesses B, right? They are the ones who said, Imanu hayitem, it's impossible for you to have seen what you claim that you saw because we were with you and we know that that's not true. Okay, and then last week we had a super duper duper complicated Mishnah with a lot of algebra. We got witnesses A, B, C, D, E, all the way through the alphabet. I'm going to summarize for you in a way that's going to be hopefully helpful and maybe frustrating because, like, oh, if that's the summary, why did we have to crack our brains so hard last week? I'm sure some of your muscles are still aching from last week's session. Essentially, last week's session, imagine the case where there's the people who testified to the original case, witnesses A. The witnesses who said, Imanu hayitem, that couldn't possibly be true. You are with us, witnesses B. And then witnesses C, D, E, F, G, ad infinitum, who all testified and said the exact same thing as witnesses A, right? They are testifying to the same event. And witnesses B keep on eliminating each subsequent set of witnesses. Okay, and Rabbi Yehuda comes in at the end of the Mishnah and he says, this is straining credulity, right? If you have this second set of witnesses B, if they keep on knocking out any new set of witnesses that come by saying Imanu hayitem, that is not actually all that plausible. Okay, and therefore we are suspicious. Maybe witnesses B are kind of in a conspiracy. Right? And they've taken it upon themselves to take care of business. Okay? Anytime anyone would come with that same testimony, witnesses B are always going to step up and say, no, that testimony couldn't possibly be true. Okay? And the dominant opinion, the Chachamim, the first opinion in the Mishnah, maintained that we always believe witnesses B. Even when 100 new sets of witnesses come, we always believe witnesses B. And on the one hand, that's consistent, right? This isn't a numbers game, okay? We just sort of follow the procedure even when the numbers don't seem to add up, okay? But the Rambam, so I think like the best way to kind of understand Rabbi Yehuda is like if you just look at what's happening, I think we all would think what Rabbi Yehuda thinks. Right, which is something is off here. Okay. But the problem with Rabbi Yehuda, the reason why the Rambam said Rabbi Yehuda couldn't possibly be correct is that Rabbi Yehuda sets up a weird scenario where we believe witnesses B to kill witnesses A, right? They're Edim Zomimim who testified falsely in a capital case. But then we don't believe them when it comes to witnesses C, D, E, F, and G. And the Rambam is basically saying, you have to pick a side. Either I believe witnesses B, and I believe them no matter what, even when it starts to strain credulity. And also, the Rambam points out that if I don't follow the dominant opinion, which essentially allows witnesses B to testify against witnesses C, D, E, F, G, okay? Then I also inadvertently eliminate the possibility of enabling a witness C to come and save the day, right? I am no longer enabling a witness C to come and testify against witnesses B. That essentially the only way that Rabbi Yehuda can function is to say, I'm not listening to witnesses C. I'm sort of cutting off the case when it gets, I've got the victim, the perpetrator, the first witnesses and the second witnesses, and then I stop listening. That's essentially what Rabbi Yehuda says. And the Rambam says, okay, in the case of our Mishnah, where witnesses C, D, E, F, G are all saying the same thing about the case, they're not testifying about witnesses B. They're testifying about the case, okay? And witnesses B keep on attacking them? Yes. In that case, it seems like there's something off with witnesses B, and Rabbi Yehuda's suspicion seems very well-founded. But if we follow him, that means we're never going to listen to a witness's C. We're never going to allow there to be a third set of witnesses who weigh in on the case. And if I don't listen to those third set of witnesses, I prevent myself from accepting their testimony in a case where we really need it. Okay, where witnesses C could come and say about witnesses B, I know it gets very confusing with the letters, you were with us. So you don't have the power to put witnesses A to death. We can establish that you're lying. Okay? So witnesses C, in order to give them some kind of weight in that other scenario, we can't listen to Rabbi Yehuda, who says that we don't listen to any testimony once we've heard the second set of witnesses. Okay, that's the summary of last week. We're going to move on. Today is a much more Gemara-heavy day. So for those of you who have been frustrated that you signed up for a Gemara class and ended up in a Mishnah class, we will be doing a lot of Gemara today. I'm going to share my screen and Esther will chat out the link. And of course, you could always find the link to the source sheet in the folder for this class. Okay, here we go. We're finally at the first Mishnah of our chapter. Okay, finally you have enough background in the actual laws of Etim Zomimim to learn this first Mishnah and to understand what's interesting about it. Okay, so the Mishnah opens with a question that I'm going to read in the Hebrew because the English, which I took from Rabbi Dr. Josh Kolb, right, already fixes the problem. So we're going to look at the Hebrew so that you have a sense of what the problem is. The Mishnah says, Ketzad ha'edim na'asim zomimim. How do we make these witnesses into edim zomimim? How do we establish them to be perjurers? Okay, that's what the straightforward English translation of that first line of the Mishnah would be. But you're going to see that Josh Kulp fixes it, okay? Because the answer that the Mishnah gives does not at all match that question, okay? The answer that the Mishnah gives is about a very specific case where you cannot do to the Edim Zomimim Ka'asher Zamam La'asot. You can't actually give them the punishment that they deserve. Okay, so actually, the question of the Mishnah is, as Josh Kulp renders it, now we're in the English, how do witnesses become liable to punishment as perjurers? Essentially, the question isn't, what is an Eid Zomim and how does one become an Eid Zomim? Because that question isn't even answered until like Mishnah Dalet Hey, right? Which is why I did that, those Mishnayot first. This Mishnah is saying, wait a minute. How does the process of punishing the Edim Zomimim work? And embedded in that question is the assumption, because you can't always have the Edim Zomimim absorb the punishment that they were trying to levy. Okay, I'm using very abstract terminology. We're going to go into the Mishnah. It's going to come very clear. If they say, Mi'idim anu bi'ish plodi, we testify about so-and-so, Shehu ben gerusha o ben chalutza, his mother is a divorcee or a person who has gone through chalitza, right, which is when you were supposed to marry the brother-in-law, but then we don't go through with it, and the shoe and the spitting, all that. Okay, that's chalutza, is a woman who unfortunately had to go through that ceremony. The laws of priesthood, state one, your priesthood lineage always goes through your father. Okay, so when I call you a Ben Gerusha and you are a priest, we already know that your father was a priest. Okay, so if your father was a priest and your mother was a Gerusha, she was a divorcee, that means that your father married someone he was not allowed to marry. Okay, a Kohen is not allowed to marry a divorcee. This can become very complicated and very painful in real life. Okay, but the laws on the books are that a Kohen does not marry a divorcee. He also doesn't marry a woman who has gone through chalitza, because that's it's a type of divorce. She was supposed to marry the brother-in-law. Okay? And so if the testimony of the Eid Zomim is, this guy, this Kohen, let's call him Bob Cohen, right? Bob Cohen, you think he's a kosher Kohen, but I have testimony that he is actually not a kosher Kohen. He is what we call a halal, because his mother and his father were not allowed to be married. Okay? So let's say that's the testimony. The testimony is personal status testimony. Okay? It's not this person owes that person money. That's easy. Give him the money. It's not even that person has killed someone. That's difficult, but it works so that you get killed. Okay? But you can't say, okay, that the Eidim Zomimim take on this personal status when it's not accurate, okay? It is not said that each witness should himself become someone who is born of a divorcee or a chalutza, right? It doesn't make any sense. So what do we do in that scenario? Lokeh arba'im, he receives 40 lashes. Okay, so if the testimony is where you can't flip the penalty back onto the witnesses, doesn't make any sense to do that. You can't change the fabric of reality and change that person's personal status. Okay, but we certainly don't let the Eid Zomim get off the hook. That is the scenario where that person would receive 40 lashes. Okay, and it is important for you to know that the default consequence when you violate a negative commandment and there's no other prescribed punishment, the standard punishment is 40 lashes. Okay, so that's where 40 lashes comes from. And if they say, we testify that so-and-so is guilty of a crime for which the punishment is exile, it is not said that each witness should himself be exiled. Rather, every witness receives the 40 lashes. Eloloke arba'im, galut. Right. This is for those of you who have been following along in Masechet Makot. This is the entirety of the second chapter of Masechet Makot. It teaches you all of the laws about someone who kills someone else accidentally. They're chased by the Goel Hadam, right? Some relative of the victim who is trying to avenge the death. Okay. The rabbis see that process of running to the Ir Miklat, running to the city of refuge, not only as a way of protecting the accidental killer, but also as a way of sentencing the accidental killer for their negligence. Okay? So if I testify about someone that they killed someone else and that that killing was accidental, I am essentially testifying about that person that they need to go into galut. They need to leave their family, they need to leave their house and move into this special city, this city of refuge. So if the testimony is that, it's not about an intentional murder where you're trying to get the guy killed so you get killed. Rather, your testimony is about an unintentional murder and you're trying to get the guy to go into galut. It doesn't make sense for you to go into galut. It's not that kind of punishment, because the punishment has embedded in it all sorts of assumptions about safety for this person from the Goel Hadam, but there is no Goel Hadam for the Eidim Zomimim, et cetera, et cetera. So we just say that, just like the personal status cases, somebody who testifies that somebody else, okay, killed accidentally, effectively testifying that someone else should go to the Ir Miklat, should flee to the city of refuge, which in rabbinic punishment terms, okay, is called galut. The witnesses don't go into galut. They also absorb these 40 lashes. Okay, so that's the first Mishnah. And now I hope you understand why we didn't do that Mishnah first. Okay, because it doesn't actually tell you anything about the default, right, scenario of Edim Zomamim. It only tells you what happens when you can't actually make the punishment work. Okay, we're going to go into the Gemara, hooray for us. We're on Makot 2a. Menahani Mile, for where is this derived? Essentially, how do I know that A, I don't change that person's personal status, okay? Maybe I do through some sort of magic wand, okay? And B, how do I know that that person gets lashes, okay? So those are the two questions that a person could ask about our Mishnah. You will see that the question in Makot is not about the lashes. It's about the why don't we disqualify this person? Why don't we change their personal status? Okay? So from where is this derived? Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi says, that Reish Lakish says, to Amar Kra, the Pasuk says, Va'asitem lo ka'asher zavam la'asot. You shall do to him as he plotted. Lo v'lo lizaro. You do something that is going to affect him, but not his offspring. Okay? The problem with changing someone's personal status, maybe he does deserve to have his personal status changed. But if you then render the Eid Zomeim Achala, okay, if you change his personal status, that doesn't just affect him. That affects his children and his grandchildren after that. Okay, so essentially the first proof text is the Eidim Zomamim can only have a punishment that only affects them, okay? If it's a punishment that is also going to taint their offspring, we can't apply, okay? And so then the Gemara says, well, wait a minute. If we're already doing magic with personal status, why don't we just do magic with him? V'lifsiluhu l'didei v'lo lifsilu l'zarei. Let's disqualify him, that is, the perjuring witness, and not disqualify the offspring. If the only problem is the technicality of we don't want it to affect the children, okay, we're already making things up. Let's do it in a way where it doesn't affect the children. So then we come back and we say, but ba'inan kasher zaman la'asot v'leka. But if we do that, okay, we are not actually going to do to the Eid Zomeim what he planned. Because if the Eid Zomeim had been successful, then the Eid Zomeim would have made the person he's testifying against a halal and all of that person's children. Okay, and so since we're stuck, right? Either if we make the Eidim Zomamim real halalim, right? We really take their personal status and we change it. Then the problem is that's not fair to their children. Right, their children didn't sin. Why are you affecting their status? And then if you try to fix it, right, quote unquote, by making this status change only impact the Edim themselves and not their children, then we run into a different problem, which is a lack of parity, right? The point of the whole Edim Zomamim thing is I have done to me what I was planning to do to that other person, what I was planning to cause them through my testimony, and what I, mean Eid Zomeim, right, was trying to do when I testified against this Kohen and said that his personal status is off, I wasn't trying to just impact him. I was planning to impact him and his children. Okay. So that's the first way that we derive this, right? Essentially, we need it to only affect the Edim Zomamim, and we need it to be symmetrical, okay? And if it's not, then we're going to do the lashes. Bar Pada says it's a kal v'chomer, okay? You guys know a kal v'chomer, but just to make sure we all understand, a fortiori, I love it when people translate Hebrew or Aramaic into Latin. And then you're like, well, now everybody understands it because it's Latin, okay? So, but kal v'chomer, kal literally means light, and chomer literally means serious, okay? And so a kal v'chomer just means if something is true about the less serious thing, It's obviously going to also be true about the more serious thing. Okay, so I'll just make up a classic kal v'chomer for you. If I am going to punish my three-year-old for spilling Cheerios all over the floor, how much more so am I going to punish him if he smashes a bottle of wine and it gets all over the kitchen, right? Because wine is much more smelly, much more difficult to clean up. Kal v'chomer, okay? So now we're going to plug in our kal v'chomer. Barpada Omer, this is a kal v'chomer, right? The reason why we don't make the Edim Zomamim themselves into Chalalim, right? Themselves into people who no longer have good Kohen status. It doesn't come from this Pasuk. Instead, it comes from this kal v'chomer. It's a logical argument. Just as one who profanes, right? Michalel is not himself profaned. So one who comes to profane but did not succeed, is it not logical that he should not be profaned? I am sure that none of you understood that. I will explain. Okay, essentially, here is the stickiness in terms of being a halal, in terms of being a kohen who doesn't have priestly status. The father who married the divorcee, he was not supposed to marry a divorcee. He himself is not impacted by that marriage. The only result of that marriage is that the children lose their status as good priests. Okay? So ha-michalel, the one who profanes, eino mitchalel, is not themselves profaned, is essentially saying the father, okay, who is the cause of all of this, is not tainted, so that how much more so someone who didn't even succeed in tainting, but just tried to, habale chalel velo chilel, isn't it logical that that person should not be a halal? So Barpada is like, well, I don't talk to me from Edim Zomamim world. Talk to me from Logic Town, okay? Come visit me in Logic Town. In Logic Town, I'm looking at the way that priestly status is constructed and priestly status is violated. A person who succeeds in taking away someone's personal status, that is, the father successfully robbed his son of being a kosher kohen, okay, by marrying this woman who he was not supposed to marry, but the father is fine, the father is not touched. Barpada says, well, then obviously, okay, the person who didn't even succeed, why should he become a halal? That doesn't make any sense. And the reason why I brought this Barpada for you is because of what Ravina said, which we just need to hold tightly and treasure. And then Ravina challenged this. Okay, for those of you who are trying to work on your Talmud skills, this type of challenge, matkif, is a logical challenge, okay? You know, we often bring challenges from sources or from authority. A matkif is like, but wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense. Okay, so Ravina comes in and he says, wait a minute, in Cain, if you want to try with the kal v'chomer, bitalta torat edim zomamim, you have completely nullified the entire law of edim zomamim, meaning the whole thing with edim zomamim. The thing about Edim Zomamim that is the weirdest, okay, that we have just been dealing with, but we never even really made explicit up to this point, is in the world of Edim Zomamim, okay, and this only is the case in the world of Edim Zomamim, I will be killed for attempted murder. Attempted murder. I didn't succeed. Someone stopped me before I had the chance. I wasn't successful, okay? Or I wasn't necessarily successful. Let's put it that way. Okay, it's a machloket about whether or not I was successful. But I wasn't necessarily successful. And still, an Eid Zomim is put to death for kasher zamam la'asot. We're punishing them for the planning. We're punishing them for the perjury. We're not punishing them for actually being successful. Okay, so what Barpa Das says makes a lot of sense. His kal vachomer, watertight. Okay, it's true. There's this weirdness with the laws of priesthood where the sons get affected and the fathers don't. Barpa Das, A plus kal vachomer. The problem with your kal vachomer is the whole idea of Edim Zomamim is predicated on we're punishing people more for what they have attempted to do than what they actually succeeded in doing. Okay? And so when Ravina comes and he says, that's the entire Torah of Edim Zomamim, he's also flagging for us, yeah, that's weird, right? But it doesn't conform to our ideas of logic. It's not logical to punish someone more for something they didn't succeed in doing. But that is how Edim Zomamim works. And therefore, Barpa Das, even though your logic is sound, you can't apply it to the world of Edim Zomamim, because the world of Edim Zomamim doesn't work according to that logic. It's its own separate world. And I will just say, like, for our comprehension, right? Because like you might take from this that then Edim Zomamim makes no sense and we shouldn't be heeding these laws and let's just throw it all out. Part of what's happening with Edim Zomamim is it looks like we're punishing them for what they have attempted to do. But I would say that's just the form that the punishment takes. The real thing that we're punishing them for is messing with the judicial system, okay? And trying to use the judicial system to do their dirty work. I want to kill that guy. I don't want to get my hands dirty, right? I want to take a knife. So perfect solution. A friend of mine and I will go together to the court. We'll testify that that guy is a murderer or a Shabbat violator or all sorts of other things that you could get the capital punishment for. And then all tight. The court is going to put this guy to death and I don't have to get my hands dirty, okay? And because we are so concerned with maintaining the integrity of the judicial system, because it's so easy to exploit, right? It's not that, I'm not saying that I'm a serial liar, but I'm capable of lying, okay? And you know what? So are all of you. It's not that hard to go in and lie. No, it's not that hard. Okay, so we need to have a kind of extreme, bonkers, out of the realm of logic level of punishment for you if you're going to get caught, because we need to have a really strong, deterrent. Okay, it's in order to be a deterrent. Okay, so Ravina says, don't be looking at the laws of Edim Zomamim and applying your little kal vachomer logic magnifying glass and trying to make it work according to what seems proportional. The whole point of the laws of Edim Zomamim is we are going to do something to you that isn't exactly proportionate, because we're going to be punishing you as if you were successful even when you weren't successful. We're going to punish you as if you were a murderer when you're just an attempted murderer, which we would never do in any other context. We're going to do it here because we have to make a point, right? We have to show that we are serious about these laws and we need to maintain the integrity of the judicial system.